Hello everyone and welcome to the Systemic Podcast. My name is Simon Osager and I'm your host here. This is the first episode, so I'm of course a bit excited, and I'm even more excited with the fact that it's my good friend Frederick, who I've been having the pleasure of working with in different extents over the last 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. So welcome to Systemic, it is a pleasure to have you on here.
Well, Fred, thank you.
And we of course go back quite a bit. You are currently the CEO and founder of the Bitcoin broker money.com, M-O-N-N-I. And we're here today to talk about Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, blockchains, and how that space has evolved over the last couple of years. Again, the idea with this podcast is to try to get a bit more into the systemic concepts. For instance, in this case, it will be decentralized currency, decentralized finance, and it couldn't happen at a better time, so to say. We are probably facing a global recession. We're seeing jobs going down all over the world. We're seeing employment going down. We're seeing that the stock markets are behaving in interesting ways, and the money printer is going brr to a very high extent. Now, this only makes it more interesting because we're also facing a pretty infrequent event in Bitcoin, where the inflation rate is going down. We will have a lot more time to get into that later. But currently, 1,800 Bitcoins is being issued every day. And that number will go down to 900 in about 48 hours, I think, when we're recording this, also known as the halving. So I don't think I could ask for a better time or a better guest to help me launch this podcast. And I'm really excited to have you here. So welcome, Frederick.
Yeah, thank you so much, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're doing this podcast in English today, which is, of course, a little bit awkward because we're both Danes. but I think both of us have been working in English for a while, and I hope we can reach almost the same level as we do when we talk in Danish. So welcome to the podcast, tell a bit about yourself. Tell about kind of your background.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Sam, for having me. It's a real pleasure to be the first guest on your on this cool concept of the Systemic podcast. Yeah, a bit about my background. As you said, I'm the founder and CEO of Money. A Bitcoin brokerage company operating here from Copenhagen in Denmark. I think I've been involved in Bitcoin for approximately as long as you have. We met at approximately the time where I started to know about Bitcoin as well. That was back in 2014. A bit about my background. I have a bachelor's degree in economics from University of Aalborg, have been come out of a family of I have three sisters and come out of a family of entrepreneurs. So that has always been kind of set in the stars that
in your blood,
exactly. That I would be working as an entrepreneur or at least self-employed. So for as long as I can remember, I've either been on a consultancy contract or short-term employment or something of that matter. So back in 2014, I discovered this concept of Bitcoin. The story that goes yeah, before that point is...
yeah, because we might have to dial all the way back to 2008, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The last time there was a crisis.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good idea, Simon, because indeed, that is actually where it all began. As the listeners can probably also recall, we had a big financial crisis back in 2008-9. And I started, my journey into that started when I began at university back in 2010. The financial crisis was, in fact, the reason why I started studying economics. I was hit particularly hard during that time. I lost my job, as most most did. I worked in transport at the time, as a furniture remover, to be specific. But at that time in Denmark, we were going from the golden days to a situation where we couldn't even put food on our table. It was such a dramatic shift from one month to the next that I just had to know what actually happened here. I had this feeling in my stomach that I needed to find out what the fuck just happened. What really just happened here? And not some, you know, news anchor excuse about, you know, if economics is complicated, something about, you know, Greeks not being productive enough or something like that. That was not an explanation that I would, that I could stick with. So long story short, I started studying economics at that time at the University of Copenhagen. But then it also dawned on me that there is different schools within economics, and I guess we can also, a lot of the talk today will also perhaps be in that area where there's no objective truth to economics as well. There is different schools, there is different models, and there is different beliefs within the academia of economics. Disgruntled with the fact that the study of the formal study of economics didn't give me the answer, I started looking at a quite convenient time, and that's where I discovered Bitcoin.
Yep. So it was kind of a disbelief in the system, and the way it was being taught at our universities, that kind of sent you down the path of Bitcoin or plan B, as some people call it.
Yeah, and that's, I think a lot of people can relate to that. For most people that I've also talked to, it started with this extracurricular activity, as something that is not a bound assignment, as something you do out of curiosity. And I think that's also why there's so many people so passionate about this subject, because, you know, it's a deeply personal journey. It was for me, in fact. It is so tied to my personality, this journey of discovery, and this journey of liberation as well. But it's such a personal journey that you find out that this concept is out there. So I really enjoyed that journey for myself, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to get into there. You also mentioned that it's a big part of personality, and I definitely seen that in Bitcoin as well, that a lot of people that get into not just Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies in general, they seen a lot of people build their entire identity on it to a large extent. And then talk about how if price goes up, your identity is good. If price goes down, you lose your identity. But we don't have to get into that now. But I think that resonates with a lot of people. I often hear it being framed as the people in that are in Bitcoin in one way or another. They're greedy. They're there to get rich, and those people are definitely there. And I think everyone is greedy to some extent. But I also see a lot of people who are just have a disbelief in the systems and the institutions that we're seeing, that don't feel like they're in control. They don't agree with how the money printer is going brr, or who's catching those dollars or euros or whatever is getting printed. So I think that's a very I guess common theme, at least amongst what you can call semi early Bitcoiners.
Mm-hmm.
So how was your first experience with Bitcoins? Like what did you do?
Well, like most, you lose them, right? that's pretty much the first experience you get, right?
Did you lose them trading or throwing away a wallet?
No, my wallet got hacked, right? So yeah, that's you, like most people, and especially most people at that time, you stumble into this field absolutely knowing nothing. And I don't have an IT background, so I didn't know what a private key was. Didn't have a reference on it. I didn't know either that, you know, who to trust with this. And so you go on this quest online, and
there's no help.
There's
like
no
you're
help.
You're in the middle of Reddit amongst cat memes and people falling over, right?
Yeah, exactly. and at that time, it was quite difficult to buy Bitcoins. The first broker in Denmark, Nordic Bitcoin at that time, just had launched. And of course, but other than that, you know, it was days of Mt. Gox.
Hmm. Mt. Gox, the one of the first very large Bitcoin exchanges,
yes,
that got hacked in a pretty spectacular way,
yes,
back in 14, I believe.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
I guess it got hacked in 13, but they only noticed in 14.
Yeah,
I think
it was February.
That's the
February
story.
14, if I'm not mistaken, the first real significant event of the time. A funny story, of course. Mt. Gox stands for Magic: The Gathering Online Exchange. As a software platform, it was absolutely horrible. It was meant to trade, you know, magic cards.
Yeah.
It was not meant to trade Bitcoins. But that was what the tools available at the time.
And that's where the liquidity was.
Yeah.
Like
exactly.
That was the only liquid exchange pretty much at the time.
Everybody was benchmarking to Mt. Gox prices at that time.
Yeah.
That was the price of Bitcoin. It was set at Mt. Gox.
Mm.
So what do you do? You're a young kid, just discovering this here and want to buy your first Bitcoins. So the buying process was quite nice from Nordic Bitcoin. That worked fine. But of course, I didn't know how to generate a paper wallet, or didn't want this massive client called Bitcoin QT running on my computer. Let's remember at that time there were no, you know, smartphone wallets. That was not an option.
And that's the whole idea with Bitcoin is it's essentially a ledger of transactions. That's how you know the balance in each wallet. And the only way to kind of run an efficient wallet at that time, or a good wallet, was to have one that stored all the transaction history,
yeah,
which would require that your laptop would be running all the time, or your... I just don't think you could do it on a phone.
No, exactly.
So it was pretty user hostile at the time, even without the hacks and the scams.
Exactly. So long story short, I venture online and find this hosted wallet, this online wallet where, you know, they say they can store our Bitcoins and they give you a fancy Bitcoin address. And yes, that's right. Your balance then increases. Then 1 month later, it shows the wallet provider doesn't exist anymore. And of course, they've been hacked.
Yep.
So, like so many others. So, but that's also, you know, a good start in this space here is
losing all your money,
losing your first batch of money. So buy, you know, good advice, buy a small amount first. Try it out before you pour your life savings into this.
Also, don't put your life savings into this.
No, in general. Exactly.
That's definitely not advisable.
Yeah. So that was the beginning of it, quite soon after I met with a guy called Alexander Lundqvist, And we co-founded another Danish broker because we found that, you know, this can really be true that there's only one broker in the market. Based on this horrible experience, we thought that we would try to change this. So in 2014, we founded Copenhagen Bitcoin started it as this hobby project that soon outgrew, you know, our wildest expectations and dreams. So so that was quite a cool journey. And my start into the venture of actually running a brokerage company.
And that happened around the time where Bitcoin kind of got into the mainstream. Like, I don't know if most people, but most younger people had an idea that it was a thing. They might not know what it was or how it worked, but the concept of Bitcoin existed somewhere in their mind. And you started to see like small Facebook channels growing up and more interest happening in Bitcoin. We also organized a couple of meetups, I remember.
Yeah, that's right.
At the time. And I don't know if you want to call that the golden age, but that was when you launched Copenhagen Bitcoin.
Yeah, it definitely had a flair to it, right? Because it was so low level. It was, you know, it was such open space. It still is, I believe, and I would invite any entrepreneur that wants to work in this field to come and try it out, because there's still a vast, you know, open field to do innovation in this space here. But at that time there were nothing.
Yeah. You were it.
We
were
it.
You and one other broker in Denmark.
Yeah. And that was the business, right? There were no big business associations or industry groups or think tanks or anything. No, that was
or conferences.
Exactly. I think we were the ones.
Yeah, we held the second conference on cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and blockchain in Denmark, I think.
Yeah, that was right.
2015,
that,
maybe?
Yeah, that was right. Yeah, about that time.
So, you launched Copenhagen Bitcoin. And then that went on for a couple of years?
Yeah. Yeah, that went on, and we started in April 2014, and in 2016, me and Alexander had, you know, as most founders can recognize, a different outlook on what we wanted to do, and where, how much time we wanted to invest in the business, you know, all of that stuff. So long story short, I decided to sell my shares in Copenhagen Bitcoin to Alexander and start what was then called WeMove Coins at the time. Mm. We started that in 2016, where we also started looking into credit cards. So accepting credit card payments as a payment for crypto.
Yeah. And of course, credit card payments for crypto is kind of the holy grail of Bitcoin brokerage in many ways, because credit cards are so ubiquitous and they are notoriously hard to kind of verify the identity behind the owner. So there's a lot of fraud. And that also means that if you're the broker that can kind of set the right fees and mitigate that fraud, you're in a good position. Did I get that right?
Yeah. I think you got it right in that sense that it is a huge challenge, and it's also for us a lucrative market, and still is, since we're relaunching the business again. But it comes with risks, yeah. And you have to be really, really good at mitigating those risks, and have to. But from the consumer end, it is easy. You know, everybody. You know, that was the original vision that I wanted to do. I had my credit card, you know, out on the table, looking for a place to buy my first bitcoins at that time, but I couldn't.
Yep.
There were no place selling bitcoins for Visa payment where I could pay with my Visa card or MasterCard and buy bitcoins, just a small amount. And I strongly believe that if by making it easy for the consumer to make their first small transaction, it is expensive to make a transaction.
Yeah, if you have the option, you should use a wire transfer, a SEPA transfer, right? Because fees on credit cards are significantly higher.
Yeah.
Because it's a it's a challenging business.
Exactly. But giving people the option to buy Bitcoins instantly, to pay with what they have in their pocket already, is so powerful. And we love convenience. You know, that's why you pay 50% more for a soda in your local corner store than you do in the supermarket. But of course, like you say, like any other good advice, it's, you know, if you want to do big shopping, if you want to do groceries for an entire week, you don't go to the corner store, right? You go to the supermarket.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, what we also advise people to do. Yeah, as you say, if you want to invest a lot, send us a wire transfer. We have strong competitive pricing on that. But if you want to get started fast and easy, then credit cards is something we believe in, is a really, really good choice. But it's super difficult, and we started out in 2016 going strong, but also learning really, really fast on what fraud looked like, what stolen credit cards looked like, and also how much bullshit there is in the payment space. It is a matter of public record that the company that we founded in 2016 went bankrupt in 2018. And the reason it did that was not because we overextended our spending or blew it all on some island retreat. Unfortunately, we ended up trusting a wrong payment processor. So like any shop that accepts credit card payments, you need a processor behind you. You need a company where you can send the credit card numbers and that can then make sure to collect the money from the card issuing bank and then transfer it to your account.
Yeah.
So it's an intermediary, and that's how the Visa and MasterCard systems are built. It's built on these acquiring banks and these processors that give you these nice payment interfaces that you can put on your website.
Yeah.
So it was a hell of a ride, we of course experienced the 2017 bubble. Which
another
was
one
of the craziest times I have ever experienced in my professional career.
So in 2017, Bitcoin and all these other crypto assets, but Bitcoin in particular, went from what, 3,000 to 20,000 within that year. $21,000 for a Bitcoin, which is still the all-time high. Then launched into what was popularly referred to as crypto winter, where the price was going down for what, a year and a half?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
But yeah, you lived through 2017.
Yeah, and it was a particularly interesting time being a broker, because you saw the brunt of people wanting to invest in crypto. I have had calls with people in December, literally begging if they could please reserve the spot for when I got stocks next.
I was, because you were running out of bitcoins. Exactly. You couldn't get money to the exchanges fast enough.
No, exactly. It takes, you know, it comes down to simple terms, like, you know, how long does it take to send a wire transfer from Denmark to Germany? Well, it takes around a day. And we were facing so big demands that we simply couldn't pump funds fast enough down to Germany, to Kraken at that time. So a huge shout out to them as well. Has been there from day one. So
Kraken is where you buy your bitcoins that you then sell to the customers. Yeah. You don't have a vault full of bitcoins that you sell out of. So you need to tap into another exchange where people are selling bitcoins.
Exactly. And that's you know, most, like, you know, that's, it's that simple, a business model. It's not super complicated. The complicated parts comes in terms of managing this fraud risk that we also talked a bit about.
Yep. And quick question. I don't believe customers lost money in your your bankruptcy. I think that's important to note.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Yes, that's absolutely true. We had loans from banks and from funds in general, from institutional investors that had invested in the company, knowing the risks. But we've always operated on this model where you buy your Bitcoins from us. That means that you send some money to us, and then within 12 to 24 hours, you get your coins. Yep. Most instances, you get your coins instantly, but that is sort of the maximum time frame that we hold your money. So that also made it very, very easy for us to mitigate that risk and to ensure that no customers lost their funds in the bankruptcy. I lost a significant amount of money. The other investors in Weem of Coins lost a significant amount of money, and the creditors, of course, lost some money as well. We are still in pursuing a court case to redeem the funds that our credit card processor stole from us or has held back. The amount is almost $1 million. Mm. So it's quite a big sum of money, at least for a small company. At the time of closing, we were 9 employees.
Yep.
So the court case still goes on, but for those of you who know how litigation works, it's a long and slow process, but we're confident that we are gonna win out this one here.
Mm.
And that's also why we are starting up again with money.
That was Weem of Coins.
Yeah.
That chapter is still waiting to get completely finished with the court case and everything. But now you've almost literally just launched money.
Yeah, exactly. It's been some time in the making, and on a personal front, of course, I also needed to take some time off and to start earning some money just to put food on the table.
Yeah.
Just last week, we completed the technical integration into a new credit card processor, made adjustments in our system so that we, in a much better way, can both combat fraud and, of course, not trust in the wrong people.
Mm.
It's such a pleasure to be back, and I've waited so long for this, but it's
and great, great timing.
Yeah.
It's so nice of you to do it just as I'm starting this podcast and Bitcoin is halving.
Yeah. It's all been part of a big plan.
I really appreciate that.
Right? Yeah. So it's been a great ride over the past couple of months. I would like to send a huge shout out to BlockTech and Weem of Ideas for doing the technical feed on this. They're partnering the company as well. And we are now in a time where we have opened up for a closed beta. You can go to money.com and sign up for a beta trial and help us fine-tune our system of buying Bitcoins with credit cards.
Yep. And maybe just for comparison, so a lot has happened since the first time you started Copenhagen Bitcoin, I believe 14, to now launching money in 2020. So 6 years has passed.
Mm.
Can't believe it's already been 6 years.
Yeah,
exactly. But you have learned a lot, but maybe set that aside a little bit and just what's different when you start a Bitcoin broker in 2020 compared to starting a Bitcoin broker in 2014? Like how has Frederick changed in that time, but how has the rest of the world changed in those 6 years?
Yeah, sure. It is a different world you're starting a Bitcoin exchange into. Since we're starting it, we still believe that it's a good idea, but the barrier to entry has definitely gotten higher.
Mm.
The obvious barrier to entry is regulation. We have had the 10th of January this year, the Danish government has ratified what is called AML D5, the fifth anti-money laundering directive.
Here in Europe.
In Europe.
Yeah.
And you're seeing other pieces of regulation all around the world taking into effect, along with, of course, FATF, this intergovernmental body.
Financial Action Task Force.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That has come out with strong recommendations for the entire civilized world on how they should deal with this. So the barrier to entry has gotten a lot, gotten higher. That's one due to increased regulation. We are subject to the anti-money laundering laws, just like, you know, your local pawn shop and any other bank. We have to follow the same rules.
And maybe just a quick kind of summary of what the FATF guidelines included was, and might be a little bit unnuanced, but essentially said the rules still apply even if you're dealing with Bitcoin. Mm. Like, there might be some nuances to it, but in general, the rules that applied before Bitcoin for financial transactions also applies after Bitcoin if you're running a financial service in one way or another, right?
Exactly. And that means that you have to have good anti-money laundering practices. You need to report suspicious activity to the police and to the local FIU.
Financial investigative unit.
Yeah, sorry.
I'll be the dictionary for all the abbreviations.
Yeah. I've been having my head down in all of this stuff for the past 6 months. So yeah, sorry if I'm running around with the acronyms there. But yeah, it all comes down to different requirements and this due diligence concept that you have to know your customers. It's a real balancing act fulfilling the letter of the law and doing your due diligence as you should, while also delivering a high convenience product to your customers. So I think to answer your question, that is mainly where we have the most challenges. That is in finding striking this good balance and coming up with creative solutions on how to make this requirement of, for example, ID verification, making that nice, simple, and easy for the customers.
Because that's one of the big challenges when it comes to compliance, not just in Bitcoin, but in general, is like knowing who you're dealing with, KYC, or know your customer. Like, who am I actually talking to? Am I talking to a bunch of scammers that stolen some credit cards? Or am I talking to the actual owner of this credit card, which is one of the big kind of burdens on not just Bitcoin businesses, but businesses in general, even from accountants to banks.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it has to, you know, you have to be creative and you have to be really vigilant with data. Mm. In order to win this game, and because it's the most easy thing is, of course, just to burden your customers with, you know, 10 pages of questions, video calls,
checkboxes,
and
I'm not a terrorist. I'm not laundering money.
Yeah, and to really make it really, really hard.
Yep.
Because by making it hard for everyone, you of course also make it hard for the scammers and the criminals to use your service. But I think there is a more intelligent way that you need to do this. And that is by using data. That is one, by using some of these transaction monitoring systems that have come out for crypto. But that is also to use machine learning and other models like that to model to give early indications of what might be fraud and what you need to investigate further, and to take this risk-based approach as they also
that's the hot. That theme of 2020 crypto? It's a risk-based approaches.
Yes. If you want the new buzzword for 2020.
If you want people in suits to smile
when
you talk about Bitcoin and risk, you want to say risk-based approach.
Exactly.
So, So there's of course the regulation. And yeah. And first off, there's a lot more of it, but there's also some clarity around it. Like if you go back some years, it was just, what the hell happened here?
Yeah.
It's more clear now, but mm-hmm. it's also made the barrier of entry higher.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
How do you see the space of brokers, maybe in Denmark or the smaller brokers or the regional brokers? How do you see that space kind of developing over the next couple of years and your role in it as well?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Well, the first obvious observation is that a lot of these mom and pop shops that existed is not going to survive. And actually, at the time of recording here, we have seen that a few, of the smaller brokerages has either shifted to a model where they simply resell the services of another broker.
And then they provide the marketing and...
Yeah. Yeah. So they have a marketing site and they sell, resell broker services from another broker. Or they go underground and start doing cash.
Slinging bitcoins on the corner in hoodies cash.
Yeah, exactly. So
hey kids, wanna buy some bitcoins?
Exactly. And that also has to do with the broker themselves, their personality, back to what we talked about in the beginning with why you got into this. Did you get into it because of this anarcho-capitalist belief? Or is there other reasons why you got into it in the first place? But to a question about what the landscape is going to look like a few years down the road, there's going to be consolidation, that's for sure.
Mm.
But the market is also growing at an exceptionally rapid pace. And I don't think we're done with new entries in the market yet. I think for example, one of my big vices with the industry is design. There's so many engineers that has built technically very capable systems for trading bitcoins, but the creativity and the good design and the feeling around that is sorely missing from the sector.
It's built by engineers. It's designed by engineers. Yeah.
And
which is good. Bitcoin was designed by engineers as it should be, but that doesn't mean that the interface of a broker has to be the same, right?
Exactly. And that's one of the feeds that we actually starting to see also some competitors do a really, really good job in having some smooth and nice design, and also this thing about being present with your consumer, always being there, always having people at the site manning the customer chats, having a phone number,
because this is new to a lot of people, even just figuring out how wallet works.
Yeah, exactly. And people get nervous about setting up their wallets, and you need to have this friendly customer service that is on the customer side, and where customers can come with not necessarily relevant questions about how do I buy from you, but also strike up conversation about what Bitcoin halving is, how does a private key function, and all of this stuff. So
private key is a fancy word for password.
Yeah,
some way.
Exactly, and I think the guys that is going to do well is going to be the people that, or the brokers that actually master this, that master the communication with the customer. And master the fact that they need to be present, and they need to be creative, and need to reinvent the communication with the customer, both on the graphical front, but also in terms of how we talk to the customers.
Mm.
Because let's not forget that a lot of people's first interest in Bitcoins actually starting out of a disgruntlement either towards the banks or the banking system, and you know how we all feel about customer service in banks. It sucks.
Yeah,
it utterly sucks
when it's open
and you feel like a criminal. going into a bank. Just you know, if you want to refinance a loan or, you know, have an incoming deposit, it's like you feel like a criminal.
You go in all hunched over. Please, sir, can I refinance my loan?
Exactly. And we cannot let ourselves, just because we are getting regulated under the same rules, we cannot let ourselves fall in the same communications trap as the banks have done. Because they always blame, you know, it's compliance, it's anti-money laundering. That's why we're asking these questions. But there's different ways of asking questions.
Mm.
You can ask questions that fulfill your obligation towards anti-money laundering without leaving the customer feeling like a criminal.
Yep.
I believe strongly that that is possible. And I think the ones that conquer that and adhere to those principles is going to win.
And that... That's almost funny, right? Because over the last couple of years, at least in Denmark, but also in plenty of other countries, we've seen the largest banks essentially getting caught up in like humongous money laundering scandals, and it always makes me think of when there was the Iraq war, and there was American troops. Literally rolling into Baghdad, and the what was the name? Comical Ali was kind of the press secretary or something, and he would almost be standing saying, "There's no American troops in Baghdad," and with tanks driving around the background pulling down statues, right? And I keep getting that picture in my mind whenever you hear the banks go out and talk about, well, Bitcoin is used for money laundering and Bitcoin's just for criminals and it's a dark economy and it becomes so hollow when at the same time they're funneling funds to God knows where, standing there on the podium saying Bitcoin's only used by criminals, and everyone can see that. It's so transparent, and when you actually dive into the data and you start analyzing the quantity of the amount of Bitcoins, the percentages of Bitcoins being used for illicit purposes, it's not that high. And there's a lot of ways to mitigate that, and which just makes it even hollower when the banks are going out with this narrative, and I would say that's probably also one of the reasons why this new regulation, it's gonna make it easier, and it's gonna make either the banks themselves will have to engage with these crypto businesses and make sure they figure out which are the ones they want to deal with. Mm-hmm. Which are the ones that running proper risk management and compliance, and which are not? Which are the ones slinging bitcoins in the corner in a trench coat? Or everything will just catch up with them. At some point, they're not the ones that decides anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there will be regulation in place, so they're obligated to provide, say, a bank account. Commercial bank account for a crypto business, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're there yet, but at the same time, I don't think it necessarily will take that long, because these are now crypto brokers, at least in Denmark and in Europe, they're regulated businesses. They're legitimate businesses. They have licenses. They have compliance programs. You can't really keep them at an arm's length anymore. And then for that picture, you still have, I don't know, the Russians running out of the back door of the bank laundering money, right? So it becomes, something must change.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. So I think we covered kind of where you're from. Kind of the status of Bitcoin now. What I would like to do is maybe just ask you a couple of questions about what Bitcoin actually is, for some of our listeners might not know that much, so at least kind of get the basics right. And then we can kind of go into the, call it more systemic questions, and try to kind of get your opinion on some of the more systemic things that has led to, like, Bitcoin is here and it's now about $10,000 worth.
Yeah, sure.
So without getting too... almost want to say ideological, at least in this point. What is Bitcoin?
Well, there's many answers to that question, but the factual answer is that it's a currency and a payment system. That's the answer that is, you know, if it was a question on Jeopardy or something like that, then that would be a correct answer. But it's bundled into one thing. That's also what confuses most people, is that they can relate to US dollars and they can relate to PayPal, but PayPal is only a payment system. It doesn't have a PayPal dollar that is individually traded to the US dollar. It's PayPal uses American dollars. It's a payment system and a currency in one.
And what makes Bitcoin unique compared to the Danish crown or the euro? Like what's separating it from that?
It's the first point is, of course, not touching too much on the systemic parts of this, but Bitcoin is different from national currencies in that they are, at least for Bitcoin's sake, they're issued on a decentralized basis. Mm. We talked about the halving.
And what does that mean, being decentralized?
That means that Danish kroner or US dollars is either issued by the Central Bank of Denmark or the Fed, but Bitcoins are issued in this process called mining, wherein a set of computers are distributed all around the world. Anybody can set up a mining shop. You don't have to have permission or get a license or anything like that.
Or send in a copy of your passport.
Exactly. No. You just crank up your computers, hook them up to the internet, and you can mine away. These computers have their first and foremost task is to verify transactions.
Yep.
It's to verify that the one Bitcoin you're gonna send me is actually one a Bitcoin that you have available at your disposal, that you have not sent that Bitcoin to someone else. And then to mitigate the information that you have sent me this Bitcoin after the fact to the rest of the Bitcoin network.
Yep.
So that the next person coming up and getting money from you can actually see that you've already sent this Bitcoin to me.
And that's because everyone is looking at the same ledger. It's digital. You're not looking at anything if you have a wallet, but behind that wallet on your laptop, there's thousands, if not hundreds, probably hundreds of thousands, of these wallets that all 100% agree on the state of the ledger, the history of all transactions. Yeah. And when we have the history of all transactions, you can deduct all balances, essentially.
Exactly. And it's, you know, a ledger is not more fancy than an Excel sheet. It's just an Excel sheet of all the transactions that has ever happened since the dawn of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And that's it.
A 300 gigabyte spreadsheet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If it's around that size at the time. I haven't checked recently.
And if you open that quote-unquote spreadsheet in China or in South Africa or in the United States or Slovenia, it all looks the exact same. Everyone is looking at the exact same data. You're not looking at the Slovenian Bitcoin server database and the Chinese Bitcoin server database. They are identical and they are communicating globally all the time. And that's definitely an interesting thing.
Mm.
And one of the things unique about Bitcoin. So that's kind of the technology. We have this mining process. We won't get into details about that. It's worked. Bitcoin's not perfect, but I would say it's pretty well built, all things considered. Mm. So you have the mining process, but why? What about the currency aspect?
Mm.
So how does that differ from say euros or crowns or dollars?
It is quite different.
Mm.
And that's also where there, justifiably enough, has been this talk. Is Bitcoin a currency? Is it a commodity? Is it a contract? Is it a future? What is this really? I tend to say that it's a currency. I don't necessarily agree that it's a commodity.
Is that part of your identity?
No.
Because my talking point on that is we can have that discussion.
Yeah.
It's more fun if you have a couple of beers.
Yeah.
And you're a little bit angry. But essentially, it's like discussing whether or not the internet is a phone.
Yeah,
exactly. Like it's pretty moot point.
Yeah,
even if you're right, right?
But it exists and it's a thing that you can buy for, yeah, and that you can buy and sell, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, but you're absolutely right. There is a lot of these points is very, you know, ideological. For example, we have a huge customer base in India.
Who just recently opened up for Bitcoins again after.
That's another point that we should probably just mention. A big shout out to the, if there's any Indians listening to this, congratulations.
Your crypto winter was long.
It was so long. But also to adjust the system. For those of you who don't know, the central bank of India issued a ban on Bitcoins, or a ban to all the banks under the central bank, saying that they were not allowed to open accounts for anybody that had anything to do with Bitcoin. They're not allowed to let their customers buy Bitcoins with the bank deposits, which essentially just shut down the entire above board
overnight, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But just recently, the High Court of India has overruled this notion by the RBI, the Indian Central Bank, and has said that it's a violation of the rights of the Indian citizens that this ban here, and Bitcoin has again overnight gone from one of the most hostile jurisdictions towards Bitcoin to one of the most friendly jurisdictions towards Bitcoin.
Because by Twitter feed, like all the Indians, all the Indian Bitcoin entrepreneurs and Bitcoin people I've been following for that, like they almost went silent, right? Like everything shut down, and then here about a month ago, you see them all kind of coming back out, doing webinars, doing marketing, talking about what's happening, doing podcasts, like really seeing that kind of this industry that's been suppressed in India is now really, really kind of bouncing back.
Yeah, and it's so amazing.
And India's quite a big country.
Yeah, let's not forget it's almost almost 1.3 billion people living in India. And if Bitcoin as a holds any promise, it's for the Indians.
Mm.
But the interesting thing about the Indian youth in particular, right, is that and in India has a very, very interesting demographics where they have this, just like we in the West had in the 60s, this baby boomer generation that
fucked everything up. Just say it out loud.
But that is a quote by your mouth, Simon. But where you went from a small generation to a large generation and a pretty well off generation.
Yeah.
That is what India is experiencing today. They have a huge youth population, much larger than the previous ones, and they don't necessarily dig their parents' ideals of gold. Gold has always been a traditional store value, huge in India.
Yeah.
You can. There is a lot of chitter on tracking the price of gold over the Indian holidays, where you know people go out and buy new jewelry and stuff like that, and that has in the gold market been huge. I think taking it back to Bitcoin, I think Bitcoin has the perfect narrative for the Indian youth. To become their digital forms of gold, to still serve,
and a pretty digital youth as well.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, and to still serve this function of being a store value away from the government, but being a store value and a hedge that is more fitting to the reality of people in their 20s, early 30s.
Mm.
So that being said, I just have a huge, just want to send out a huge congratulations to all Indians for this windfall here, and also just follow what goes on in India. It's significant.
Yep. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. Okay, a little bit back to Bitcoin and the currency aspect, and I love these kind of side quests and these tangents, and that's definitely a thing that I want to make room for on this podcast. So if there's options, like we can go all the way down the rabbit hole, maybe never to emerge again, but that's the really interesting part about getting people on like you that has this pretty in-depth knowledge of, say, the Bitcoin markets in India. But let's quickly go back to the currency aspect of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like what's the difference from Bitcoin to traditional currencies as we know it on the currency side of it?
Yeah, I mean we've talked
monetary
about
monetary policy.
Yeah, we've perhaps talked about decentralization, of course, that there is in traditional fiat currencies, we have this board of old, typically white men, bright men, that sit around the table and decide on the amount of currency, the interest rate, and these pretty key and central concepts. But that's not the case in Bitcoin as the currency. In Bitcoin, these rules are set from the outset. We don't necessarily have a single group that is able to control them, either the money supply or the interest rate, or manipulate the mechanics and the monetary policy of Bitcoin.
Yeah, and how many Bitcoins are there right now?
I think there is around 18 million Bitcoins in existence right now.
Yeah.
We have the Bitcoin protocol has been built in such a way where
the rules of Bitcoin,
yes,
essentially, exactly. The what the engineers wrote down,
in the so that we can maximum reach 21 million Bitcoins somewhere out in the future.
Yeah,
as you opened the podcast with saying that there is a certain amount mined every day, that's going to drop here in less than 48 hours.
As it does every fourth year.
Yeah.
That's also why even after just 10 years, we have 18 million with a maximum of 21.
Yeah, exactly. So it's this curve that sort of flattens out over time and goes towards this 21 million Bitcoins that can never be mined.
And you can own less than a full Bitcoin. You can own fractions of a Bitcoin.
Yes.
This won't be something for 18 million people.
No, you can buy a 10 millionth of a Bitcoin. I think that's one Satoshi.
That's one Satoshi, yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a millionth. I'm not. I think it's a tenth of a million. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can come, and that's also what we do most. If you buy Bitcoins with credit cards from us, you don't get a full Bitcoin. Sorry.
No, it's too small.
You get
not even if you ask nice.
No. You can't buy $10,000 worth of Bitcoins on a single credit card transaction.
No.
You can come and you can buy a maximum of 500 euros worth of Bitcoins. And that would give you 0 point something Bitcoins worth.
Yep.
But again, it's a fungible currency. It doesn't really matter if it's a 0 point something. And regarding the price, it's also just, it's a bit funny that we say that Bitcoin is either cheap or expensive. It's the same if, you know, if the Amazon stock suddenly they make this they took half of all the shares out of circulation and then the price doubled. Would it be expensive then? No, because there's fewer shares in circulation. We need to remember that there's not a lot of Bitcoins in circulation, full Bitcoins, and the value of Bitcoin is the supply multiplied by the price.
Mm.
So that's also the dynamic that you always have to keep in. And having the supply be fixed gives makes it so that the only thing that can move if more people want to put value into it and if the market cap of Bitcoin needs to rise is the price.
Mm.
So that's a really what's called an inelastic supply.
Yeah.
The economist would call it that. Yes.
Yeah. And that's I guess also what leads to this high volatility, right? So, and I don't necessarily want to talk too much about price, but Bitcoin went from nothing, like literally worth nothing, zero, to around like $10,000 today as we're recording this episode. And in between, it's been everywhere. It's been at 20,000, it's been at 200, it's been going up and down. And for those that's been in the space for a while, you kind of get a little bit desensitized.
Yeah.
But I think you actually said it the best. I think I can't remember what we were doing. I think we were drinking a beer, sitting and talking. I was like, so Frederick, what do you think? The big economist, what do you think the price of Bitcoin's gonna be? And then you sit down and you kind of look out and like really think for a couple of seconds, gaze, and then you kind of go back. Well, I think that depends on how many people are interested in buying or selling Bitcoins.
Gold nugget right there, right?
And it's so perfect. I've stolen it, used it for several occasions. Mm. But that's the very simple truth of it.
Yeah.
Like if there's more, like there will be after the halving, 800 Bitcoins will be issued every day. If people want to buy that for more than they're buying Bitcoins for today, the price will go up. And if they don't want to pay the same, the price will go down.
Yeah.
Now we know that they want to pay about $10,000 when 1800 is coming out.
Yeah.
Maybe they only want to pay half when there's half as much supply. Nobody really knows, but it doesn't really matter what we say or think. The thing that dictates the price is, do people want to buy or sell Bitcoins, or and at what price?
Yeah, and let's also remember that we have that if you're new to Bitcoin, please remember that it's not that. I know a lot of things about Bitcoin is complicated and technical, but supply and demand is not that complicated.
No.
It isn't. And if people try to tell you that it's complicated and it's fancy and that they have found a new formula for this, they're probably out to take your money. So please beware and please also trust your own intellects in this here. I can't stress that enough. We need to believe in ourselves and that we can get our head and mind around these difficult concepts. We don't need experts to tell us everything.
No. And I think that's a good couple of disclosures. I've been very vigilant to not try to predict the price. Mm. That's not the game I'm playing. Also not telling people to buy Bitcoins. That's kind of my personal principles. It's super interesting. But at the same time, no one knows what's going to happen. Like, there's decentralized currency now. Bitcoin works pretty well. Mm-hmm. If you kind of take a technical look at it, it's I would say it's kind of beautiful in the way that these rules and these protocols have been engineered. But it's in no way perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been pretty secure. Like, Bitcoin hasn't been hacked. There's mm-hmm. been cases of bad wallets, but the ledgers have kept its integrity. Most wallets are pretty secure. But there's no one to help you out. You're kind of on your own. So you need to actually, like, if you're the type of person that writes down your password on a post-it and sticks it under your keyboard, you probably want to take a look at how to do proper password management before you start getting into Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
So take a look around your apartment. If there's a post-it note with a password on it anywhere, don't buy Bitcoin just yet. You still have a little bit of homework to do.
Exactly.
And that's also the difference. Like, Bitcoin, you're sovereign. Like, you are actually kind of stepping out of the system. And that's, I guess that's the really interesting part. So why are people buying Bitcoins, Frederick? Because you sold a lot to them, and you've seen the people buying Bitcoin. Yeah. So what's your impression?
People buy Bitcoins for a number of reasons. That's of course the boring answer first. I wanna tell you a story about a client that we've helped over the years. Of course, I won't mention his name or anything like that. He's a bit of an atypical client because he is in his 70s. He has been a gold bug, if you want to say it like that, for a number of years.
So he's been buying gold coins.
He's been buying gold. Yeah, exactly.
Physical
gold coins.
Yeah.
Putting it in plastic sheets, sleeves, and keeping it in his safe in his basement. He found Bitcoin, and he found Bitcoin to be super interesting, and found similarities to the market he has been in for the big part of his life, which is gold. One day he sold half of his gold bullion holdings, and came to us, and we helped him place the remaining half of his fortune in Bitcoin, and that was prior to the Bitcoin bubble and everything.
He's good.
He is good, definitely. But he's also a good example of this. You know, he didn't. I don't believe that he bought Bitcoins as a scheme to become rich. He bought it because he saw the ideological similarities and the new innovation that Bitcoin adds to his traditional mindset, being the gold the gold mindset. So coming out of that, I think a lot of people invest out of their own personal belief. A belief that most people can't put, you know, take and point out concretely, say, why did you buy Bitcoin? Well, I just believed in this here, and I've heard about it, and I think it's a good idea, and I think this is going to be the future. Do I know how Bitcoin is going to be the future? No, absolutely not. Most people have no clue, and people like us who's been in the industry for quite some time also had a very, very hard time. You know,
I still don't know what to say.
Exactly.
Like, right? I need a podcast of 2 hours to like just scratch the surface, right?
Exactly. So I think it comes down to a personal belief that either comes in the form of an inspiration from people saying, aha, Bitcoin, that is something new, I want to test that. Or as a fuck the banks.
Yeah.
As a saying, fuck the banks, I don't want to be part of this monetary policy that they're implementing more. I want to get into an alternative.
It's fuck you money.
It's fuck you money, right? and that's I think is the clearest answer to your question, that is the two different reasons why people are buying.
Yeah. And I can relate to that. Like, this is the second crisis in my adult life, right? Like, I'm closer to fuck you money than, and I think a lot of people in our positions and of our demographics and age, like, they have a bigger disbelief in institutions. And just to go back to what you said a little bit earlier, I think you're still looking at these very old institutions running the same monetary policies that they have for a while. You've seen the Americans been going hard for a while. You're seeing Europe starting to print as well. It feels like this time things might change.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's a lot of young people that really hope for that now. And maybe it will. I don't know if Bitcoin's the solution necessarily. Mm. It's again, it's not perfect, but it's it's interesting. Like it's been going. Bitcoin's been working for 10 years now. A decentralized currency, not controlled by single individuals, starting to get pretty well integrated into the traditional economy, getting easier for people to buy, to sell, more liquidity in the markets, institutions, banks stepping in. It feels like we're on the verge of some change. Like, what do you think is going to happen? Like, do you think Bitcoin's actually going to push through some change?
I don't necessarily think it's going to be Bitcoin that pushes through the change. I think and hope that we will be ready for when this change happens. I think it's the other way around, to answer your question shortly. I think it's going to be changed by the youth, like we've seen in the climate crisis. That is still not gone just because we're in COVID-19.
No, we just have a new crisis. We're stacking them like Pokemons.
Exactly, right? So it's you know, there's going to be change, but change is not going to come by itself. It's going to come by young people saying enough is enough and that wants alternatives. And it's then our job, or in my case, I see it as my job to try to build some of these alternatives. And one of the alternatives is Bitcoin. It's not a perfect alternative. It's in many cases a worse off alternative.
Especially during crypto winters.
Yeah. For any time, you don't want to put your have your salary in Bitcoin. You don't want to pay your rent in Bitcoin.
You can't, right? Like, there's not enough capacity on the network.
Exactly. Like, so it's an inferior system, but in many cases, it's a good alternative to if or when shit hits the fan. So, but I truly believe that.
Are you saying we're gonna get more crises?
Yes. Yeah, that's I can guarantee you. But you know, who knows?
There should be like a ceiling. Like, you can have a maximum of two concurrent, like two crises at the same time.
Yeah, I think we've breached that ceiling quite a bit. So talking into the current crisis, I think is quite interesting in what we can what we've learned here. So we started off the year with a huge awareness of the climate crisis, that in a lot of sense stems from this chase for eternal growth. We have been pushed into this paradigm where we need to grow our economy perpetually.
Like the boomers. We were put in this world to continue that trajectory, right?
Yeah, I mean at least the mindset that the baby boomers had, that we could just dig an infinite amount of oil from the ground, build new houses, there was always be more land, there was always be, you know, we could just throw stuff in the ocean.
Always be new technology, always be new.
Yeah, no problem, right? And that we could just continue that. Our generation and the millennial generation, the younger people, the people that are younger than us as well, have a radically different view and outlook towards this concept. And I think that's where we start. That's where the change starts. It starts with these people not believing in the eternal growth story of our economy anymore. And that's also where Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies become even more meaningful. Is, you know, nobody can print more. We can't have an exponential rise in the supply of Bitcoins. Bitcoin and the rules, the protocol, as we mentioned before, is very
that we
much
all agreed on.
That we all agreed on when Bitcoin was created.
And when you bought Bitcoin, you consent to those rules.
Exactly.
Well, you have to.
Yeah, there's not much to do to change it, at least, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's a set of rules that harmonize really, really well with the new realization that we cannot grow forever. That we need to limit our growth, and that we need to adjust to a world where we don't have internal growth, where we sort of work toward this tangent of this equilibrium, or this place where we have sustainable development and sustainable growth, meaning that we of course grow in advancement with technology and more knowledge, but we don't grow at an expense of natural resources and the environment.
And the workers and
worker rights, you know, the whole shebang, right? It needs to be sustainable. And I think that is also why it's super interesting, the situation we're in now, and then taking it back to the last crisis and the most current crisis, the COVID,
which we solved perfectly. maybe not.
that's also out for the judges still. But taking it back to that, it gives us an opportunity to stop and to take some time off and evaluate if the things we're doing is still gonna work in the new in this new system, both on a very personal level, job situation, are you in the right job, are you in the right marriage,
are you locked down in the right apartment,
exactly do you, and at least for myself on a personal level, you know, going into the COVID-19 crisis, there was this, you know, we need a bigger apartment, more income, you know, summer house there, stuff like that. But as you go on, you sort of say, no, perhaps I just need, you know, 10 square meters more to, you know, so my kid can have his own room, right? But I don't need more than that. And I think that kind of mentality is also what's going to be very beneficial for the crypto movement, or the crypto movement is going to play into that narrative really, really well, that we don't necessarily need all this stuff, that we can do with a lot less and still be happy, because, you know, stuff is not going to buy you happiness, sorry to say.
Yep. That's easy to say, all those things. Like, getting the world to agree or comply is probably a lot harder. How do you see that play out? And kind of to follow up, is trading euros for Bitcoin, is that betting against growth? Is that discouraging growth? Is that betting against the money printer incentivizing growth? Like, what happens when you buy Bitcoin compared to doing what you used to do?
Yeah, a very, very good question, because it is a contrarian play, as you want to put it, right? It is a play saying, I don't necessarily believe in the status quo. I want to take an alternative route. And that's very powerful. So buying bitcoins is a F you to the money printers and the central banks.
So it's back to the fuck you money.
Exactly. It is, you know, it is putting a strain. So if everybody did that, it would be a serious problem for the central bank. But it's more saying that I don't like to see that this is gonna be a violent revolution or something like that, where we have to go out and be violent to someone or something. I think it has more to do with the fact that you need to be sovereign, as you put it yourself, right? You need to be an adult and take, you know, the right decisions for yourself and your family. And I don't believe you're doing that if you don't own a little bit of Bitcoin at the time.
That's a strong position.
It is. I think there is so much uncertainty about...
Also a convenient position for a Bitcoin broker.
You know,
just stating the obvious here.
Of course, and that's a fair point. That's a good disclaimer that you need to put on this, right? So yes, I do sell bitcoins, and you can buy them from me.
Yeah.
But that being said, I think there is so much risk in our current system, and And the current setup where we have nation states, we have national currencies that are issued by a central bank that is essentially controlled by the banking system. Mm. And where the integrity of the currency is so much intertwined with the mistakes and the fuck ups that normal banks are making on an everyday basis.
Mm.
I think we really need to ask ourselves, and I think a lot of young people are doing this here, is that the right alternative? Do we have the best system that can be? And my answer is no. We have a debt money system, not a debt, but with, you know, liabilities and debt. And that's not a very good system from an engineering point of view and from an economist.
And it also creates these, I think on another podcast, I heard them referenced as embedded growth obligations with all this debt, right?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that there, you know, there exists more debt in the world than there exists money, which is strange. How can that be?
Yeah.
So if everybody used all the money they had to pay off either their own or someone else's debt,
we'd be out of money but still have debt.
Yeah. And significantly more debt than there is money. So inherently there's something wrong with the system. And that's also some of the, you know, stuff I found out during this extracurricular study activity, is that the system serves in the interest of some people, you know, on the back of other people. We can have an inherently more fair system, an inherently more equal system, if we limit the money creation by the banks and the ability for banks to create money out of thin air and lend it out at interest
to their friends
or at high interest rates to you and me, right?
Yeah.
So that's pretty much where I think we're obligated to actually take an active stance here if we want something to change. We cannot just sit back and relax and expect change to come to us. We have to do something actively, just like we have to change our behavior actively to do something about the climate crisis.
So is Bitcoin activism? Because Bitcoin is, and for those who don't know, maybe I can shed a little bit of light on the history of Bitcoin, right? For many years, since the mid-80s, kind of activists and idealists and computer tech nerds have kind of had this dream of digital money, digital cash, not controlled by a bank or government, right? And of course, you couldn't do that in the 80s because you were lacking something quite essential that everyone now have everywhere, which is the internet, right? So Bitcoin was not a new concept, but all the different examples of people trying to start quote unquote decentralized or semi decentralized currency were shut down. Like, cause there was always this centralized server. There's always a door to kick down. Cause it is illegal to print your own money.
Mm.
Like, you're not allowed to do that. And that meant that, and I believe that was the Secret Service actually came for people who ran a computer in their basement with money. Mm. So I couldn't start up a computer in my basement selling Simon crowns. Like that's just not legal, and that got shut down because of that not being legal, right? Mm. So all these different examples of people trying to start decentralized currency didn't really succeed. Until this guy who called himself Satoshi Nakamoto with the pseudonym made the Bitcoin white paper. And what the Bitcoin white paper essentially did, the proposed Bitcoin protocol, was taking this mining and distributing that So everyone could mine. Everyone. There was not a server. There was no basement. There was no doors to kick down. Mm-hmm. Everyone was just part of the network, and could mine new Bitcoins. Everyone could join in and create transactions. And then he also coupled it with this deflationary monetary system, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of supply early, and then that would taper off. And it's actually worked like that since. So in 2009, Satoshi Nakamoto starts the Bitcoin blockchain. He starts mining, he starts doing some calculations on it entirely alone. Or maybe it was a group, but there's just Satoshi in that pseudonym working on it, right? Mm. And Bitcoin was released on, it started mining on January 3rd. And one 2009. And one smart thing he did was he actually took a headline from the Times, which is a British newspaper, I believe, because Bitcoin is based on calculations.
Yeah.
Who were to say Satoshi hadn't been doing these calculations since the year 2000?
Mm.
Like nobody could actually know that. But by taking this headline of that from the Times, he actually made that part of the math problem. Which sounds a bit abstract for us. For a computer, this is super easy to make a piece of text into like a mining puzzle.
Yeah.
And that literally means that every single block in the Bitcoin blockchain and every single transaction that ever happens in the Bitcoin blockchain is some sort of permutation of the headline, which read Chancellors on the verge of second bailout for banks, which is inherently either an exceptional kind of coincidence or inherently a political statement or an ideological statement, right? We are still recovering from the financial crisis, and these institutions that have been deemed too big to fail, they can do no wrong, they will get bailed out, now need their second bailout. Mm-hmm. And he made that statement the very core of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like every single transaction is mathematically and cryptographically linked to that statement.
Mm.
I don't know if that answers my own question. Is yeah. Bitcoin an act of activism? But I think there's some beauty in that. Like there's some there's definitely something aesthetically very pleasing about that fact that every single Bitcoin transaction happening right now is in one way or another quoting bailouts for banks.
And I can personally relate a lot to that because, you know, I've also been, you know, active on, you know, back in the high school days, I was active on the left, the left side of parliament, or
the left side of Denmark.
Yeah, or more like a social social democrat youth politics, but even up to when I started working with Bitcoin, I was involved in this activism called Move Your Money. It's also present in the UK and where it simply
it's
say,
also called Change Bank Day, or
yeah, I think that's it. That was the at least the Danish variation to it, where we simply, you know, try to make the general public more aware that they have an active choice in choosing what bank they do business with. That there is good banks and bad banks out there. That there is small community banks that serve a really, really good and important purpose to the local community. And there is bad banks that do other things. Let's not get into that. But to the point about activism, then yes, I think it is for most people. But let's not forget that it might not be for everybody.
Mm.
We, you know, the amount of reasons why you get into Bitcoin is as plentiful as there is people in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That's just the fact that we are so different, and that's also the beauty of this
ecosystem. You're trying to almost squeeze your political opinions onto Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
Like you're trying to say, well, because Bitcoin, kind of my position is justified and right. Maybe it is. Maybe it is.
But it, right, but it isn't. It is. It is. You cannot do that because Bitcoin is technology.
Yeah, it's like discussing whether it's a phone or like the internet is a phone, right? It's just it's an iteration of that same discussion in many ways.
Mm. Yeah, because it's not. It's a piece of technology. It's like a hammer. It can use to be used to build a house or to kill someone.
Mm.
So let's not try to make it a good and an evil. It's just a tool.
And it's there. And it's working, and it's in pretty well integrated in our financial system. I think that's, we didn't have that the last time there was this much interest in Bitcoin.
Well, it's going to be exciting the next couple of months to see how things go, definitely.
Yeah, when everyone's locked in, sheltered in place, at least we can watch the Bitcoin drama. Because Bitcoiners are drama queens. Let's not, like, this is, and I think this is another of the disclosures. It's not a pretty place. Like, you essentially have everyone from all walks of lives, all backgrounds, trying to project their own values onto a decentralized and digital protocol, which is a futile attempt in many ways, I would say. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit, there's this cartoon, I can't remember who wrote it, where there's a bunch of blind people touching an elephant, right? And one's touching that hind leg and said, I think it's a tree trunk. And one is touching the what the hell are they called? It's snabel in Danish.
I don't know.
The thing sticking out of the front of an elephant, for those at home. And they say it feels like a snake or something, right? Bitcoin's a little bit the same way.
Mm.
And then given the fact that a lot of Bitcoiners are male and they are technical and they like to argue, and some of them's gotten very rich, which probably kind of creates a feedback loop into like the narcissism and the kind of
social awkward
And that's not to shit on any Bitcoiners. Some of the greatest people I've ever met in my life have been part of that. And I don't think everyone has to be like, there's room for being disagreeable in Bitcoin. But I understand people trying to check out crypto Twitter or trying to read articles or just trying to watch an interview get put off. Because you're looking at everything. Like, you wouldn't take a look at the people working with Danish crowns, like people holding Danish crowns or investing in Danish crowns, and kind of judge them all in one bucket, right? And I think that's also part of the kind of the proposal of Bitcoin. Like, we can sit across the table and we can disagree about everything. I can think you're the most horrible person in the world. Your politics is horrendous. But at the end of the day, like, we're still on Bitcoin.
Hmm.
Like, we would still be transacting in Bitcoin. Our Bitcoin wallets are still talking the exact same language, irregardless of how much we disagree on the higher levels of everything, right? And that's what we see as well. You can use Bitcoin in China. You can use Bitcoin in the United States. You can use Bitcoin in Denmark. You can use Bitcoin in Hungary. It is in many ways kind of a unifying platform that we just haven't, like, you can't even use the same social media platforms around the world.
That's true.
But Bitcoin is just there. It seems to get into every single crack and nook and cranny of the world. You have Bitcoin nodes communicating over the Tor network anonymously, sharing information about the ledger, relaying transactions. You have I think you actually have two satellites now in orbit, beaming down the Bitcoin blockchain.
That's cool.
I think it'll take like a month or two to get the entire blockchain. but I could literally go online and buy a couple of cheap electronic devices, a little what do you call that, an antenna, parabola. And I could actually, without having a phone, without having an internet connection, without having anything really, I can now actually go outside, put up my little antenna, and I can read the entire history of the Bitcoin ledger.
That's pretty cool.
Not as decentralized as some other ways of doing it, But that means I can actually, just with a little antenna and a computer, no internet access, I can actually have a wallet. I can receive Bitcoin and I can confirm 100% that I have those Bitcoin. I can't send them because I'm not online, but I could at least get the history. Mm. And I think that's very impressive. I think it's very impressive that you can do. I don't know if people need it.
No,
I don't think they do.
But I also think that is not, you know, necessarily a criteria that people necessarily need it. I believe very strongly in having, you know, us that know about this and have worked with this and have decided like you and me to spend our entire lives in this field here, and to actually have that that we have an obligation not to convince people that this is a good idea.
That's also super annoying. Yeah. You don't want to be that guy. No. Don't be that guy or girl.
Exactly. But to present and build the alternatives, I think that's where we need to focus and work with. Is not necessarily to convince everybody that this is the future, but to actually build tools and content as well to give a good impression of what it is and to give the tools that people need to succeed in this space here.
Mm. Maybe we can just quickly cover what happens at the halving. Like what are some of the things people normally do at halvings? Maybe cover some of the more kind of lighthearted Bitcoin kind of memes or things that Bitcoiners do that's not about burning down the system or starting a revolution or yelling at each other as Bitcoiners sometimes do. But what happens at a halving? What did we do at the last halving?
Well, you and me, we tried to set up this Bitcoin halving party.
And nobody showed up, did they?
No, I think there was one other guy from some forum that showed up. But it was outside and it was pre-corona.
And he wasn't even in Bitcoin anymore. He was investing in Steam or some other block. I think he spent half the day talking about that.
So, but it's, you know, there is this moment where you're suspended, where you're waiting for the next block.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can see that block.
A block is a block of transactions that comes every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And the block, the halving will happen when that block is issuing 6.25 Bitcoins instead of 12.5.
Exactly. So we know exactly what block number will show the 6.25 Bitcoins. So there is this funny suspense moment where we're all standing and waiting, and some of the crooked things about the Bitcoin system is that, yes, on average, it takes 10 minutes for a block to arrive, for the next block, between the time between one block is mined and the next block is mined. But, you know, sometimes it could take 2 hours.
It's purely probabilistic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there is a tiny probability that it will take 12 hours or 24 hours until the next block arrives. Of course, it is a normal distribution, or what's called Poisson distribution to the statisticians out there. But it, you know, when you're sitting and you're watching this and you have open just a cold beer, because last time it was also during the times of
summer,
good weather,
yeah.
It was summertime. It holds this funny suspense moment where you're waiting for something that can arrive in just 1 second or 10 seconds or 30 seconds or in an hour.
Mm.
So, but what people do, I mean, I tend to drink a beer and just reflect a little on what we have accomplished in the past 4 years.
It's been four pretty significant years.
It has, and we have experienced quite a lot, both ups and downs. And I also tend to think that, you know, here it goes again. Here we have another proof of how resilient the Bitcoin system is.
Mm.
It survived another 4 years without a single second of downtime, which is pretty fucking amazing. So it's a lot of appreciation for the people who created this, and it's also an encouragement for me at least to to get out there and spread the message of crypto and Bitcoin, but also just to make it even more convenient for people to get into
even more convenient for people to buy Bitcoins on money.com.
That's right.
And I think we should end here. You're of course very, very welcome to come back at another time. I genuinely couldn't have asked for a better person to help me start this podcast. So I really, really appreciate that. It's been a pleasure to have some of these types of conversations that we normally have over a beer, and try to, first off, have it in English. I think that went quite well. But also open it up to a wider audience, and definitely something I plan on continuing with. This won't be a Bitcoin podcast. I hope to dive into a lot of different topics, but for the first episode, the industry I've worked in for the last 5 years, having you as a guest, all the timing fitting perfectly together, it's been an absolute pleasure. I don't know what the politically correct way, maybe it's an elbow bump. So thank you very much for coming on the Systemic Podcast, Frederick. I see you at maybe a small remote halving party in a couple of hours.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me, Simon.
All right, it's been a pleasure.